Well, good evening. Turn with me to Job chapter 11. Job chapter 11, where our study resumes at verse 1. I'm not going to take any great deal of time to remind you or to review what we looked at in our last study, except to say that at this point in his suffering, Job has determined that even though he's innocent of any and all wrongdoing, God is still allowing him to suffer. Why? Well, he has no idea. He's not privy to the conversation that God had with Satan, the allowance that God gave Satan to do anything short of killing him. And so it's a great mystery to him why he continues to suffer. And his only thought on the matter is, his only conclusion is that God must allow suffering to happen to the just and the unjust. He has no idea, again, why any of this is happening. All he knows really at this point is that it would be better had he never been born. He says in verse 19 of the previous chapter, I should have been as though I had not been, carried from womb to tomb. Simply put, Job has reached rock bottom. His suffering has not abated. He is bewildered as to the cause. He's really at his wit's end when it comes to the amount of suffering that any mere mortal should be able to endure. His only hope was, from this point forward, that God might be pleased to leave him alone, that God might be pleased to withdraw from him so that he might have at least a little bit of cheer. Now, we've already heard from Job's two other friends, Eliphaz and Bildad. And here in chapter 11, it's Zophar's turn to offer his counsel. Before we begin examining what Zophar has to say, though, let me just say a word or two about these three friends, so-called. When I say things like that, I'm not meaning to imply that they were wrong about everything that they said. There were some things that they got right. There were some things that they said that are in perfect alignment with the rest of Scripture in terms of what we know about God and how He deals within the realm of humankind and so on and so forth. And it's tempting and it's easy to write them off as being theologically incorrect, insensitive, self-absorbed, and aloof, because there are times when, even though they do say some things correctly, there are times when they demonstrate those particular characteristics. They are unloving, insensitive. They don't understand either what's happening. They're very quick to make accusations and to draw various assumptions based upon their own limited knowledge and so on and so forth. But again, a number of things that they say are correct. And so I was preparing for this message tonight, and I came across something written by 18th century Anglican pastor Charles Bradley that really helped me to see these men in a much more balanced way. Let me just read to you what he said, and this should be a fitting way to set the stage for what we're about to read from Zophar. Bradley noted this. He says, speaking of these friends, he said, they have a firm belief not only in God's power, but in His unerring righteousness. They hold also the precious truth that He is a God who will forgive the sinner and take back to His favor him who bears rightly the teaching of affliction. Surely, so far, a very grand and simple creed. We shall watch their language narrowly, and we shall still find in it much to admire, much with which to sympathize, much to treasure and use as a storehouse of Christian thought. We shall see also where and how it is that they misapplied the most precious of truths and the most edifying of doctrines, turned wholesome food to poison, pressed upon their friend half-truths, which are sometimes the worst of untruths. We shall note also no less that want of true sympathy, of the faculty of entering into the feelings of men unlike themselves, and of the power of facing new views or new truths, which has so often in the history of the church marred the character and impaired the usefulness of some of God's truest servants. We shall see them, lastly, in the true spirit of the controversialist, grow more and more embittered by the persistency in error, as they hold it, of him who opposes them. The true subject of this sacred drama is unveiling itself before our eyes. Has he who serves God a right to claim exemption from pain and suffering? Is such pain a mark of God's displeasure, or may it be something exceedingly different? Must God's children in their hour of trial have their thoughts turned to the judgment that fell on Sodom and Gomorrah, or shall they fix them on the agony and bloody sweat of him whose coming in the flesh we so soon commemorate? I think this is a really balanced way to see these three friends of Job. They did have a great deal of things to say that were correct again, but they were still, at times, very judgmental, very presumptuous, and so on and so forth. In short, I think, you know, these men are very much like us. We're very quick to judge others as well. I would cite the recent controversy surrounding Alistair Begg. Alistair Begg, as you know, gave some really horrible advice to a grandmother concerning her gay grandson's wedding, and you know, people lost everything. They just lost it when they read about it. It's easy to be an armchair quarterback and say, well, how dare he? I would never do that, and so on and so forth. But what's not really wise is to throw out the testimony of a man who online has tens of thousands of hours worth of faithful biblical preaching just because he messed up. Just because he messed up one time. And yet we're very quick to do that to people, right? We judge people unfairly because of some one thing that might characterize them as something that they're clearly not, based upon the preponderance of their ministries. And so I would caution us all from doing what Bildad's friend or Job's friends did. They judged him unfairly, right? And we, in turn, can judge them unfairly. Remember, they have limited light. They're not really privy to a lot of the gospel truth that we are now beholden to. They don't really understand a lot of the finer points of doctrine that we now take for granted. And so I believe it's wise to take this balanced approach to such men. And I think that's what Bradley points out very eloquently. Now, here's the thing. Paul urges Titus in Titus 3, 9 through 11, to actually do what I'm advocating, and that is to avoid foolish controversies. There are so many controversies out there that we could engage in, right? But I think it's wise to avoid those things, as Paul urges Titus, avoid foolish controversies and genealogies and strife and disputes about the law, for they are unprofitable and worthless. Reject a factious man after a first and second warning, knowing that such a man is perverted and is sinning, being self-condemned. Now, I realize that's probably a sermon, another sermon for another day, but you get what I'm trying to say here. We don't need to imitate Job's so-called friends, neither do we want to be those who unfairly criticize men that we don't even know, really, right? And I'm not saying we give the benefit of the doubt to error, known error. Call out error wherever you see it, but make sure you don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, right? We ought to give each other some grace when it comes to the times that we do misspeak. The things that we might occasionally say that might be completely innocent. We don't mean to say some of the things we say. How many of you have ever said something you didn't really mean to say? Right? How many times have you been raked over the coals for having said that thing when you confess, I didn't really mean to say that thing? You get the idea. Well, I just wanted to set what we're about to read here in this particular context. Just because Job's three friends weren't batting 1,000 here doesn't mean that they weren't able to get on base now and then, to use a baseball metaphor. They actually have both good and not so good things to say, And these things should be instructive to us in terms of how we approach our brothers and sisters in Christ. Read with me beginning at verse 1. Here we read, "Then Zophar the Naamathite answered, 'Shall a multitude of words go unanswered, and a talkative man be acquitted? Shall your boasts silence men, and shall you scoff and none rebuke?'" This is fairly unkind, right? People often, those who are suffering especially, tend to talk a lot. Many people talk a lot because they want to talk through their issues. They want to use you as a sounding board. And some people just talk a lot because they have that kind of nervous tick where if they are unsure, unsettled, the more that is true, the more they talk. Basically, Zophar is accusing Job of being a motor mouth. "Job, you've said a lot, and it's time to stop and allow me to interject," right? We all know people like that. I've been guilty of that myself, where we just talk incessantly without anybody being able to get a word in edgewise. And Zophar is approaching Job along these same lines. And Job does, in fact, get a tad bit out of hand with regard to his choice words directed at God. Remember, Job has said things about God himself, accusing him of unfairness, impropriety. And again, these are all born out of his bewilderment. He doesn't know what's going on, so he's just left to assume the worst things about God. And Zophar simply challenges Job by reminding him that it's never profitable to let a man speak so many words without allowing for the interjection occasionally. In fact, the Septuagint renders this passage in part, "He who speaks much should also hear in turn, else the fine speaker think himself just." There are many people who believe the more words they can say, the more believable their arguments will be. It's funny, though, because during Job's time, the so-called Oriental people, the people of that region during this particular time, lived by a certain code of ethics, and part of that code of ethics was the less you can say, the better. A wise man speaks far less than a foolish man. And so that's part of their thinking. This is part of Zophar's justification for calling Job out. He's basically saying, "Job, you sound like a foolish man because you're just running on and on and on." He's basically saying, hold on right there. Some of the things you've just said need to be addressed. And so, again, we have scriptural evidence, really, to back this up. Solomon said in Proverbs 10:19, "When there are many words, transgression is unavoidable, but he who restrains his lips is wise." So again, the more you say, the more trouble you're likely to get into. That's certainly wise counsel. James speaks to this as well in James 1:19. Remember what he says there? "Everyone must be quick to hear, slow to speak, and slow to anger." That's also good counsel. Anybody here ever guilty of just letting their mouth get engaged before their brain does? Right? We do that. And the prohibition or the warning here is that we should not do that. So the first thing Zophar wishes to bring to Job's attention here in verse 2 is his tendency to use a whole lot of words to say very little of actual importance. So the second charge, verse 3, is against Job's boasting or his scoffing spirit. He asks Job, "Shall your boasts silence men, and shall you scoff and none rebuke?" He's wanting Job to understand just how inappropriate he sounds. And again, some of the things he said are entirely inappropriate. And he wants him to understand that just because he's saying many words doesn't make him right. Again, very good counsel. Not only that, Job's boasting went beyond a mere contention of his innocence to actually scoffing at God. For Zophar, such boasting, especially this kind of boasting that leads to scoffing in the face of divine sovereignty, simply can't stand. We should never give someone enough rope to hang themselves. If you're ever in a discussion with a brother or sister, and that discussion takes a decided turn toward the heretical or toward the disrespectful or the inappropriate, what should you do? You stop them. Hold on right there. We're not going to carry this conversation on because you're treading on dangerous ground here. It's only appropriate that we do that. Now, in Job's case, he just went on and on and on and on, and Zophar didn't interrupt him, but now it's his turn to chime in, so he's going to dress Job down for those very things. Zophar takes this even further in verse 4. He gives an example of Job's boastful scoffing. He says, "For you have said, my teaching is pure, and I am innocent in your eyes." This is likely a reference to what Job said in the previous chapter in verse 7. Remember what he said? He said, "You know that I'm not wicked, and yet there's no deliverance from your hand." That's not appropriate in any sense of the word, is it? I mean, to tell God, "You know I'm innocent, and yet you won't relent in terms of relieving my suffering." Be careful. Be careful. I mean, as I've noted a few times in this study, according to what's written back in chapter 1 and verse 8, God did know that Job was not wicked. In fact, he said of Job, "There's none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, fearing God and turning away from evil." So on the one hand, Job was correct in his self-assessment. I'm not evil. I'm not one who is guilty of sinning against God, so why is he continually subjecting me to this suffering? But on the other hand, Job is still guilty of sinful boasting. How so? Well, first of all, in spite of any sense of his own inherent righteousness, Job should have nonetheless considered himself to be a sinner. A right understanding of who God is and the praise and glory that he is worthy of receiving from us, realizing who we are not in comparison to God, should naturally have a humbling effect on us, right? Job should have been humbled by what he was experiencing. Whether he was guilty of any known sin or not, Job should have known that he was at least guilty of original sin, right? Remember, it's not necessarily the sins that we commit that condemn us. It's the fact that we are of our father Adam, who plunged the entire human race into sin. And so our individual sins are the byproduct of original sin, but it's the original sin, it's our status as those identified in Adam that condemns us. Yes?
Are you not thinking of the verse of today? Because, like, our knowledge is what we would know of God. Because we're given the Bible, we know so much more than we could possibly know.
I think Job would have known at the least that he was in Adam. I don't think Job would have claimed to have been perfectly sinless. Right? Right. So there were certain fundamental facts that were known even as early as Job. God detests sin. God sends sinners to a place of torment. That was known in the earliest stages of man's development, right? After the fall of Adam. So I'm not going to say that Job was unaware of those things. No. No, the only reason God ever declares any human being righteous is based on the positional righteous righteousness that we have in Christ. No man ever, except Christ himself, has been practically righteous. Right? Because let's put it this way. If what Job did by way of offerings and prayers uttered for his family and so on and so forth, if those things were equatable to practical righteousness, that means that at some point works were sufficient to save someone. That was never the case. Never the case. And so for Job to be truly righteous and not just positionally righteous would mean that he would have to be perfectly sinless. Job should have known he's not perfectly sinless. In fact, he's demonstrating that he's still in sin by saying some of the things that he's saying against his God. Right? So, again, we need to be careful that we don't. Although Job didn't have all the nuanced theology that you and I have today, based on the scriptures, right? He still had enough light to know that God deals with sinners, and he is one of them. So, yeah. So again, Job had this awareness, but here's the thing too. Job didn't actually understand what God thought of him. I don't know that he would have known that, right? Job only knew what he thought of himself, which invariably led to boasting and scoffing at what he believed was God's unfair and unjust treatment of him. Job would have done well to heed the counsel of Solomon in Proverbs 27:2, where he says, "Let another praise you and not your own mouth, a stranger and not your own lips." Paul would later write to the Corinthians in 2 Corinthians 10:18, "It is not the one who commends himself who is approved, but the one whom the Lord commends." And this is why Zophar says what he does in verses 5 and 6. "But would that God might speak and open his lips against you." Here's the telltale proof that they knew. Zophar's saying, would that God would tell you himself that he disapproves of how you're behaving. So that indicates at least Zophar knew that God didn't accept that kind of disrespect, that kind of inappropriateness, and show you the secrets of wisdom. For sound wisdom has two sides. Know then that God forgets a part of your iniquity. Once again, I like the simplicity of the New Living Translation here. Not that I recommend it. I don't, but sometimes it gets it right. Job is being told here, if only God would speak, if only he would tell you what he thinks, if only he would tell you the secrets of wisdom, for true wisdom is not a simple matter. Listen, God is doubtless punishing you far less than you deserve. I like that. Why? Because it's absolutely true. I don't care what suffering you undergo here, this side of glory, how righteous you think yourself to be, even positionally righteous, God still allows the positionally righteous to suffer, either for sins that they have committed or as a way of molding and shaping us more into the image of Christ. We're all beholden to him as the author and the finisher of our faith. And along that route of sanctification, whatever that might be for each individual here, it could include a lot of suffering. We will suffer if it be God's will, again, to mold us and shape us more into the image of Christ, to fit us for heaven, as it were. And so Zophar is saying that very thing here. No matter what your level of suffering here, it's much less than you actually deserve. What do we deserve at the hands of a thrice holy God? Just by virtue of our identification with Adam, just by virtue of our original sin, what do we deserve? We deserve instant death. We deserve an eternity in torment. That's what we deserve. But God is pleased to only cause us to suffer temporally. Job's going to find out that all of this was temporal. This was just by God's design. You know, one of the things that fascinates me the most about what Job didn't know, Job had no idea that a book would be written about him that would be so instructive to us in terms of why God allows suffering, why God causes people to suffer for His glory and for their own good. And so again, we can see the finished product here. We can connect the dots and see, okay, this is, you know, it might be that the entire reason Job was allowed to suffer as much as he did was so that we would have a book about him that would comfort us in our own suffering, right? But again, make no mistake about it, I think Zophar is exactly right here. Job could have suffered 10 times as much as he was suffering, but it still wouldn't be what he actually deserves. And so you talk about insight. Zophar's talking on a high level here about things that we might be tempted to think they weren't even aware of at the time, right? So, God in His mercy, though, doesn't punish us as harshly as we deserve. The problem with what Zophar says here, though, is that he's making the same blunder as both Eliphaz and Bildad before him. He's assuming to know the mind of God relative to the cause of Job's suffering. Right? He's, again, as true as his statement is, that Job's not suffering to the extent that he should be suffering, he's still attributing Job's suffering to sin. And original sin, yes, but not the kind of sin that Zophar, Bildad, and Eliphaz had in mind. These three friends were convinced that Job had done something to offend God, and that's why he was suffering. Right? So, again, it's a right and wrong statement. Like Job's other two friends, Zophar's not content to simply sit and commiserate with Job. That's what we should do, by the way. You know, when somebody's suffering, you don't go to them and say, what sin did you commit? Even if it's original sin, what do we do? What should we do? We should comfort them. We should weep with those who weep and rejoice with those who rejoice. We should at least just have the wherewithal, like they did the first 7 days, to sit with him and just be there for him. When someone's suffering, when someone's down, that's not the time to attack them, right? Now, when they get restored or whatever the case might be, you can certainly sit with them and use those sufferings as teaching moments. But during the height of suffering, that's not the time to walk up to somebody and say, what'd you do? Right? Can you imagine? You know? Somebody suffering from a terminal illness and you, what did you do to make God mad? No. Listen to an excerpt from the Biblical Illustrator that I believe perfectly captures my own thoughts on all this. I wish I had a name to attach to this, but you know, the Biblical Illustrator is just put together by editors. Nobody's really sure who wrote what, but the author writes this: the charges, if true, could not justify the spirit and style of the reproof. Considering the high character and the trying circumstances of Job and the professions of Zophar as his friend, there is a heartlessness and an insolence in his reproof most reprehensible and revolting. There's no real religion in rudeness. There's no divine inspiration in insolence. Reproof, to be of any worth, should not merely be deserved, but should be given in a right spirit, a spirit of meekness, tenderness, and love. Reprehension is not an act of butchery, but an act of surgery, says another. There are those who confound bluntness with honesty and insolence with straightforwardness. The true reprover is of a different metal, and his words fall not like the rushing hailstorm, but like the gentle dew. If you're going to reprove somebody, do it in a spirit of meekness. Do it with the idea that but for the grace of God goeth I. Do it with the realization that whatever's happening to your friend, you deserve worse. There's a real value in humility among believers. We're going to talk about that this coming Lord's Day. Lord willing, we're going to look at what remains of Romans chapter 12. No, we're not going to make it through the whole thing. But we're going to look at what remains in Romans chapter 12 relative to our responsibility to love one another and to care for one another and to seek one another's best interest and so on and so forth. We're exhorted to do these things because, again, we live with the realization that whatever's happening to someone, no matter how heinous, how horrible their suffering might be, we deserve the same and more. And so we do reprove them if necessary, but we do so with very gentle touches. I think we can learn a thing or two from Zophar about how not to approach the issue of suffering in others. It is entirely reasonable to connect the dots in terms of their error and the consequences, but we need to be very careful. We need to be very prayerful in our approach, lest we be guilty of adding insult to injury. Zophar continues in verse 7. He asks Job, "Can you discover the depths of God?" I mean, Zophar, can you? Right? No. "Can you discover the limits of the Almighty? They are as high as the heavens. What can you do? Deeper than Sheol, what can you know? Its measure is longer than the earth and broader than the sea. If he passes by or shuts up or calls an assembly, who can restrain him? For he knows false men, and he sees iniquity without investigating." Now, there's certainly a lot that we might disagree with here, right? I mean, again, Zophar is pretending himself to know the mind of God. He's attributing yet again everything Job's experiencing to Job's falsehood in some way. He's saying, be careful, God can spot a false man without even having to investigate, right? These high-sounding words are actually very condemning, very haughty, very arrogant. But there's also a lot that we would agree with here. God is, in fact, incomprehensible with respect to his being and his perfections. And again, let me qualify what I mean by incomprehensible. I don't mean that there's nothing about God that we can understand. I simply mean that God in his totality is incomprehensible. We can't even wrap our brains around the concept of infinity and eternality. We know notionally what that means. To be eternal, to be infinite, means you have no beginning and no end. Okay, we get that, but can you even fathom living in that reality? The fact that God himself has no beginning. Anybody got a firm enough grasp on that to explain that? I don't know what that means in its entirety. I do understand it conceptually. But again, it's not possible to know everything there is to know about God. And again, even the things that we do know about God are all hypothetical or notional. As one theologian noted, he said, we can conceive of a future, but not of a past eternity. That a being should always exist without beginning is what men will never be able to fathom, either in this world or that which is to come. What about God's omnipresence? How many gods do we worship? One. How is it possible that the one true God is everywhere? At all times? We don't understand that. What about his knowledge, wisdom, and power? We can't understand that because all of those things are infinite as well. He has infinite knowledge. He has infinite power. We don't understand those things. We know about them notionally, but again, we don't understand them. In the context of Zophar's speech, he wants Job to understand that no one, not even Job on his best day, is able to know what's going on in the mind of God and why, how, when, and where he does the thing he does. But note that irresistible barb that Zophar throws in verse 11. We don't understand all there is to know about God, but we understand one thing. He knows false men, and he sees iniquity without investigating. Then he goes on in verse 12 to say something really strange. He says, an idiot will become intelligent when the foal of a wild donkey is born a man. Folks, I have to admit, when I read that, I was like, what does that have to do with anything, right? I couldn't make heads or tails of it. Then it dawned on me that Zophar is actually using the equivalent of a when pigs fly argument. He's saying an idiot stands about as much chance becoming intelligent as a donkey giving birth to a human. That's what he's saying. Is that directed at Job? Probably. Is that kind? No. No, not at all. Given the context, again, Zophar's wanting Job to understand that claiming to know the mind and eternal will of a sovereign God is foolish. But isn't that what Job's three friends have pretended to understand? We have to be very careful, again, to see both the good and bad in what they're giving him by way of counsel. They're saying a lot of things that are true, but they're also making a lot of presumptuous arguments. They're also assuming a lot in terms of understanding or pretending to understand what's in the mind of God. He goes on to say in verses 13 through 19, if you would direct your heart right and spread out your hand to him, if iniquity is in your hand, put it far away and do not let wickedness dwell in your tents, then indeed you could lift up your face without moral defect and you would be steadfast and not fear. For you would forget your trouble as waters that have passed by. You would remember it. Your life would be brighter than noonday. Darkness would be like the morning. Then you would trust because there is hope. And you would look around and rest securely. You would lie down and none would disturb you. And many would entreat your favor. Now again, what Zophar says here is true. It's entirely true. We would all do well to put away iniquity. We would all do well to instead turn to the Lord when we're weary, when we're down, when we're worn by the things that constantly seek to drag us down. It's true that when we do that, when we look full on the face of Jesus, as the hymn writer said, turn your eyes upon Jesus, look full in his wonderful face, and the things of this earth will grow strangely dim in the light of his glory and grace. It's absolutely true. Absolutely true. Our troubles would be like water under the bridge. Our lives would be brighter. Our trust in him would be greater. We would rest more securely in him, and even our social life would be better. But Zophar is quick to remind Job, the eyes of the wicked will fall or fail, and there will be no escape for them, and their hope is to breathe their last. Zophar can't help himself. He'll say something encouraging and follow it with a barb, right? All this is true, Job, but maybe not for you. Right? You get the idea that he's standing in judgment of his friend. You know, all these wonderful truths, these things are just wonderful to behold. And he would do well, Zophar would do well to have stopped without the barb. And yet, again, he can't help himself. The eyes of the wicked will fail. That's what I'm seeing in you, Job. There will be no escape for them. Their hope is to breathe their last. After all, hadn't Job done this a couple of times already? Be better if I'd never been born. It'd be better if I was transported from the womb to the tomb. His own wife, curse God and die. Just get it over with. And so again, I think this is another pointed barb used by Zophar to chastise Job for some of the ways that he has spoken about God himself. Well, Lord willing, we're going to see Job's response to Zophar's speech next week. I'll be here next week. I'm leaving Thursday evening for 2 weeks, going on vacation. But I'll be here next Wednesday, and Lord willing, we'll continue at chapter 12. Anybody have any questions?